Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin. A little later, former Budget Director Bob Emerson and Senate Majority Leader Ken Sikkema, now with the Consensus Policy Project, will be joining us. Also, John Roehring will be talking with Doug Rothwell, the outgoing Executive Director of Business Leaders for Michigan. But first, some commentary from the state's political world. An unusual Memorial Day weekend, to be sure. Governor Gretchen Whitmer reopened businesses in northern Michigan and the Upper Peninsula amid the coronavirus pandemic. Although unless you owned property up there or knew somebody who did, there wasn't much point in going up north. The hotels and the campgrounds were both closed, probably as a deterrent for people to go up north. Some in the state are still hesitant to move around too much because of the risk of contracting the disease, but many more people in the state did move around. Whitmer's stay-at-home order that was extended until mid-June on Friday has been reduced to kind suggestions in the minds of most Michiganders. The Unicast tracking system, which uses cell phone apps to track the movement of individuals, reported this weekend that the number of people moving around as of Friday was nearly the same number reported on March 9, the day before the first confirmed case of COVID-19 was reported in the state of Michigan. The safer at home order is being ignored. Republicans seem to be encouraging the movement. Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey tweeted on Saturday, quote, go enjoy your weekend. Make it a grand Memorial Day. You'll not forget, end quote. He also tweeted a Detroit Free Press article of an Indiana border billboard welcoming Michiganders to their, quote, free to roam state that ends with the tagline, we thank you for the revenue. It's a bizarre world we live in to think that Michigan residents would willingly travel south to Indiana on such a beautiful weekend as opposed to Indiana residents traveling north to Michigan. Some didn't, of course. They made do with the accommodations that were available. On Saturday afternoon, the number of vehicles coming into the Holland State Park overwhelmed the limited parking available. Cars coming in were turned around in an immediate U-turn back out. The ungroomed beach was still littered with brush and sticks and other stuff left over from the winter storms. The buoys weren't out and the water was ice cold, but there were still plenty of visitors. None of them were wearing masks. The only two people seen wearing masks were the DNR employees doing parking control and picking up garbage. One of them was wearing it below his nose. People are being emboldened to violate the order in part because the numbers of those dying from COVID-19 continues to fall. Only 5 people were reported to have died from the disease on Sunday, which is the fewest number of casualties in literally 2 months. But you're not hearing more about it because the state's weekend reporting numbers have tended to be artificially low. The Mother's Day number for COVID-19 deaths was 25. Easter Sunday's was 95. So clearly things are improving and people are noticing. Not everyone was enjoying the weekend, though. The tiny town of Sanford was cleaning up from the overflowed Tittabawassee River submerging their town last week. Midland Daily News photos show the huge amount of debris being loaded up into dumpsters to be taken away. The people who lived on what was Wixom Lake now have a view of a muddy field. People are walking on the now exposed earth, even though emergency officials urge people not to. There's still a fear of flash flooding. Still, nobody has been killed by the 500-year flood. 2 other thoughts I wanted to share here. First one is Karen Whitsitt. Over the weekend, the 13th Congressional District Democrats announced they will be endorsing Roslyn Ogburn to unseat Karen Whitsitt in the 9th State House District after unanimously censoring the state representative for praising President Trump and his approach for handling the COVID-19 crisis while openly criticizing Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Remember, Whitsitt said she nearly died from the disease until she received hydroxychloroquine and that it saved her life. Whitsitt has been off script from mainstream Democratic caucus members for some time now. I've learned that Whitsitt is trying to recruit Democratic consultants in Detroit to help her with her reelection bid and is getting turned down. She has put herself on an island where only Republicans seem to want to swim out to meet her. She attended President Trump's African-American roundtable at the Ford event on Thursday with John James. Rumor has it that Whitsitt may endorse John James, who is also African-American, for the U.S. Senate seat. Why has Whitsitt gone off in this direction? From talking to her, she has taken the attitude that others, like maybe Harvey Santana or Virgil Smith, has taken in sessions past, but to the extreme. Their attitude has been the Republicans are in charge, so the only way to get anything done for their districts is to work with Republicans. Better to get a quarter loaf or a half loaf than nothing at all. Whitsitt is frustrated by playing the loyal opposition card. She sees plenty of her colleagues going that route. Doesn't feel like joining them with an all-or-nothing approach has any value. She hasn't abandoned what she believes in. The one thing that she contributed to the roundtable was urging President Trump to support the establishment of an historically black college and university in the city of Detroit. Trump urged John James to get on that, and it'd be politically brilliant if he did. Regardless, Whitsitt's effectiveness only works with Republicans in power. If the Democrats retake majority this fall and Whitsitt is reelected, it's fair to say she will not be receiving any committee chairmanships. And speaking of her reelection, don't presume that because the Democratic establishment is working against her and she's not getting maybe some of the consultants she would have liked, that she's a dead woman walking. As one consultant told me last weekend, nobody works like Karen Whitsitt. She's hitting the doors this weekend and will continue to do so. Will Rosalind Ogburn? Will Mark Cummings, another candidate in that race? There's also a fourth candidate in that Democratic primary, Nicole Hillcock, another political unknown. That's what's going to make the difference in this particular race. In Detroit districts, it's all about hustle. And the person who's able to get out, knock doors, meet people, and connect are the people who win. And if Karen Whitsitt's the only one doing it, it doesn't matter who else is running, she will win re-election. And finally, Joe Jurgensen of Libertyville, Illinois, won the Libertarian Party's presidential nomination this week in a contested convention that went to the fourth ballot. The day-long virtual meeting had 1,035 delegates participate, according to Reason Magazine, which reported on the scantily covered event. It adds to the speculation that U.S. Representative Justin Amash pulled out of the race last weekend out of concerns that he would not win the party's nomination based on what he was hearing from delegates and did not want to suffer a politically embarrassing defeat. Now, that said, Amash has been more vocal about his support for the Libertarian Party this past week. Amash isn't necessarily out as a potential Libertarian candidate for his current third congressional seat. On Friday, Bill Ballinger had Bill Gelinow on his Political Insider program. Gelinow was the Libertarian candidate's gubernatorial nominee here in the state of Michigan in 2018. He said that Amash could be nominated at their state convention to run in the 3rd Congressional District, whenever that convention ends up being. The current hope is that they can pull something together in July up in Gaylord. Amash collecting signatures to run for Congress as an independent is still possible, since he's ended that presidential bid. But there are no signs he's doing it. If he truly wants to carry the Libertarian banner going forward, his best bet may be to win the nomination for the third party and give it a run in November. It's not expected he'd win, but he could boost the party's profile in West Michigan by getting double-digit percentage votes in the November general election. And he would put an abrupt end to the seemingly inevitable coronation of Peter Meyer as the likely next member of Congress from the 3rd Congressional District. Regardless of what they say in their fundraising pieces, the Democrats want Justin Amash back in this race to pull votes away from Peter Meyer to benefit their candidate, Hillary Scholten. If Amash gets into this race as a Libertarian and runs an aggressive campaign this fall, the Democrats have a shot at the 3rd Congressional District. If he doesn't, I see the Democrats pulling this one off the political playboard fairly quickly, barring some drastic changes in the political landscape nationally and in West Michigan.
Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I
went down. Join me on the other end of the line now are a couple of familiar names, the folks here in Lansing, Ken Sikkema, the former Senate Majority Leader, and Bob Emerson, former State Budget Director, and also former Senate Minority Leader back in the aughts or the 2000s. They're now working for the Michigan Consensus Policy Project, where they are coming up with some ideas on what legislators and policymakers can do as we try and balance out the state budget amid the COVID-19 crisis and the economic troubles that we're facing right now. So as you guys are taking a look at this budget, what we're looking at is much different than maybe we're used to in that things were chugging right along and all of a sudden we just kind of hit a cliff. But Bob, back when you were budget director,
seemed like every time you were in front of the legislature, it was apologizing for having to gut a program that you really liked. Is this going to have to be more of the same where we're gutting programs, or how do you see things being able to get worked out for legislators?
This is a very unique situation. You know, I mean, as you said, things fell off a cliff, you know, but 2.5 months ago, the economy was going along just fine. I think the state was looking at having surplus and additional revenue, and things looked like they were going just fine. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have 25% unemployment. Nobody is working. Half the businesses in the state are closed. People are locked up in their houses, most of them voluntarily, some forced. But, you know, for the most part, nobody's out doing anything related to commerce. So that kills pay revenue. There's no income tax from people not working. No sales tax from most of the retail establishments being closed for the last 2.5 months. You've got a really unique situation, and I know the Revenue Estimating Conference just concluded. I think they said there was a combined general fund and school aid fund shortfall this year of about $3.2 billion. It's only about a little over 4 months left in the fiscal year. So that's a problem no one would want to try and manage their way out of. Significant $3 billion shortfall for next year projected by the same Revenue Estimating Conference. Those are huge numbers, and even though the state has some money in the rainy day fund, I think back in the early 2000s, John Engler showed us $1.2 billion can go in an awful hurry.
Can you cut your way out of a hole like this with only 4.5 months left to go into a fiscal year?
I don't see a way you could do it without shutting down massive amounts of state services, creating all kinds of problems for local government, creating all kinds of problems for universities and schools. There just isn't a way you can cut your way 4 months, 4.5 months left in the fiscal year out of that. You know, I mean, in the past, there have been times, I think, during the last years of Governor Milliken, I think we extended the fiscal year by 3 months to give themselves a little more time to try and work through the problem. But to make those kind of cuts this late in the fiscal year would be impossible. And that's why I think Michigan, along with every other state, is certainly imploring the federal government to come through, and they've helped business, they've helped airlines, they've helped individuals. I think they're going to have to do the same with state and local government to some degree, you know. I mean, probably not anything like the package that passed the House recently, but they're going to have to do something because every state is hurting, and it's not a Democratic or a Republican problem. It's a fiscal problem for everybody when you have the economy shut down for 2.5 months.
I wanted to get Ken Sickerman on this. Do you agree that it's got to be a federal government solution? I mean, we do have a $1.2 billion rainy day fund out there.
Oh, there's no question in my mind that we're going to need federal assistance. You know, the $1.2 billion rainy day fund disappears in a blink of an eye. And although I do agree that some of that needs to be used to help this current fiscal year, it wouldn't really be prudent to exhaust completely the rainy day fund. You're going to need that over the next 2 or 3 years. So that could be part of it, but only a small part. There's just, Kyle, no question in my mind that given the size of this hole and how quickly it appeared near the end of the fiscal year, that federal assistance is going to be absolutely critical to this. It can't be done without it.
Now, what about raising gas tax? You guys had advocated for that more than, well, we're getting on about a year and a half ago now. You know, gas prices are pretty low right now. What would you think about raising the gas tax to fund the roads and using all that money from the general fund that currently goes to roads and using that to help balance the budget?
When we advocated an increase in the gas tax a year and a half ago, first of all, we advocated a 9-year phase-in for a gas tax increase. Now, admittedly, starting right away, but times were also good. The economy was good. You know, I basically agree with some of the principles, well, with all the principles that Bob and John Walsh, budget director, former budget director for Rick Snyder, put forward a few days ago, where You know, when you shut down the economy and shut down businesses, put people out of work, it's probably not a good time to add insult to injury by saying, oh, by the way, you know, you're going to have to cough up more in taxes. No. But that being said, you know, the general fund has got, is part of the problem here. I mean, you got the general fund and the school aid fund that we're talking about. And it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, given the problems of the general fund, that you continue to use between $400 and $600 million a year to go to roads. You know, that money really ought to be dedicated to other purposes right now. But, you know, Bob mentioned the sharp decline in the sales tax and the income tax collections. Well, that's also happened with gas tax collections because people haven't been driving. They've been staying at home. But in the grand scheme of things, we ought to be looking at federal assistance, use of the rainy day fund. There's going to have to be some budget cuts. I think the state should consider some borrowing tools that are now newly available. But I generally speaking, I don't think it's time to look at tax increases.
What do you think of that idea, Bob? Do you agree about the gas or about tax increases now not being a good time for that?
Yeah, I think, well, Ken and I have had a lot of discussion about this, and I agree with him, you know, that this is probably not a good time to talk about tax increases because you have so many people who are out of work. You have so many businesses that are struggling to try and figure out how to make it under new circumstances. You know, you're going to have restaurants that, you know, I mean, I saw some statistic about restaurants needing 75% capacity to break even. And, you know, I think when they open up, you know, they're talking about trying to limit them to 50% capacity. You're going to have businesses all over the state struggling. You're going to have individuals struggling, you know, and I think probably is not the right time to look at tax increases. And both John Walsh and I stated that, and, you know, we ought to probably do a thorough review of our tax structure to make sure that we still have one that's efficient and fair. But I think raising taxes right now ought not be part of the equation.
I wanted to get your guys' opinion also on how the governor is doing and kind of this legislative standoff that we have. And I wanted to start with you on this, Ken, because as a former Senate Majority Leader who was working with a governor from the opposite party, you have an appreciation, or one of the few who've had to work in this kind of environment. Did you agree with what Mike Shirky and Lee Chatfield did as far as suing the governor over this and the fact that she's extending these executive orders without legislative approval?
Well, you've got two different questions sort of buried in your general question. You know, it's a different question, I think, to say whether she's done a fairly decent job than whether or not the legislature ought to have more input into this. And my answer is different for each question.
Okay.
And that doesn't mean that her decisions or her responses to this pandemic have been perfect by any means. But I think generally speaking, she's done a decent job of responding to it and how she's responded. Now, I also, though, don't agree that you ought to have a situation where the governor can just sort of act unilaterally in perpetuity, which, you know, is basically what's happened because she's relying on that 1945 law that, at least up to this point, has allowed her to just sort of roll over these emergency situations without getting legislative approval. I would prefer that we use the 1976 law, which after 28 days, if she wants to keep using, you know, declare it an emergency, she's got to get legislative acquiescence. But that's a different question than whether she's generally done a good job or not.
Okay. So did you agree then with the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker's approach by suing her after she went ahead and issued that first rolling executive order, emergency declaration?
I would have done the same thing they did.
Okay.
Because it's the only avenue they have of trying to get court clarification that the legislature has a role after the first emergency declaration. So I would have done the same thing they did. That's a different question.
Okay.
As regarding whether or not she's done a fairly good job or not. It's a constitutional issue about the role of the legislature and the role of the executive branch.
And then, Bob, I wanted to get your opinion on this because obviously you were in the legislature as well, but you've also been in the administration. So what's your thoughts about the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader suing the governor for these rolling executive orders and her emergency declarations?
You know, I mean, I think this is one of those situations where the legislature feels like they need to be part of the solution, yet nobody has come forward from the legislature offering any solutions. They just want to complain about the fact they weren't the ones making the decision here. And there's no question in my mind that you had an emergency. The governor acted appropriately. You know, how long you continue with that is really an open question. And I think, you know, the legislature should be included in the discussion of that. But it's really hard to get a consensus on what to do in a situation like this and what's best for everybody. And I think it would be a really difficult thing to get 148 legislators to agree on what steps ought to be taken and all of the specifics that ought to be included in the way you deal with this kind of an emergency. You know, she's done a good job. I think she could have probably tried to engage the legislature a little more than maybe she did. But, you know, I'm not there day-to-day basis, and none of us know exactly what was going on behind the scenes. And, you know, a bunch of this appears to be rooted in pure politics, although I agree that, you know, the legislature ought to have some role in this, but I don't think you could find 148 legislators who are going to come up with a specific plan of action here.
Because I wanted to see if there was any anything in particular you guys wanted to bring up that I haven't asked about.
I would just point out, Kyle, that when Bob and John Walsh put together these principles, you know, it was, well, we're going to have to we need federal money. We're going to have to need that. We're going to have to use part of the budget stabilization fund. But when they got into budget cuts, you know, they basically said that we shouldn't be looking at just, you know, pro-rata cuts. We ought to be prioritizing government services along the same lines when they talked about the tax structure. Was, well, it's not a time to raise taxes, but we ought to be doing a review of our tax system to make sure it's still fair. So that's the only piece that we really hadn't talked about is on the budget side is, hey, you know, let's prioritize these things and not just, you know, take some kind of meat axe approach.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that because obviously there are going to be some cuts. And so when you talk about prioritization then, Ken, are you saying what are you putting here near the top of the priority list?
Well, health, education, public safety, I think, are at the top. But more than that, and you probably can't do it in the short term, but we ought to take this opportunity to look maybe more long term at, you know, what services are provided by what level of government and begin thinking about some real solid structural reforms. That will take some time, admittedly.
And those are always very difficult discussions to have, too, when you start getting into territorial roles and who's doing what. But obviously, if this thing is going to hang around a while, structural reforms are something that has been talked about before and will probably continue going forward. Well, thanks so much for the time today, Ken Sikkema, former Senate Majority Leader, and Bob Emerson, former Budget Director and Senate Minority Leader. They are now with the Michigan Consensus Policy Project, and they worked with John Walsh, also a former legislator and former legislator and budget director, on a article in Bridge talking about the economic hardships and some ways out of it. Thank you again, guys, for the time today.
All right. Thank you, Kyle.
Joining us today on the podcast is Doug Rothwell. He is the president of the Business Leaders of Michigan. He is retiring. First off, congratulations on your decision to retire. You will be missed, however. I want to start with a quick question, though. Tell me, over the career you've had in Michigan, what one issue you tackled sticks out most in your memory?
Well, the thing, John, that was the most fun and the thing that I feel like I got the most reward out of was the setting up of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. It was such a rewarding experience because it was new. It was a new model, this public-private partnership, and also because it impacted positively so many people's lives. I mean, I've never had a job where I could touch as many communities and people as I did that one. And that's what motivates you in the work that you do. At least it motivates me for the work that I did. And so that's the one that really stands out to me the most.
One of the things that we've covered you working on a lot over the last several years is the push to get Michigan to be a top 10 state, to get us there, to keep us there. From a policy standpoint, as you've worked on that, what has been the one issue you found the thorniest to try to resolve as you sort of work towards that goal?
Yeah, well, we've talked about this before. It's this kind of consistent inconsistency that we tend to have in Michigan. And I know it's a national problem, too, right now. But I think that in Michigan, it's been more so over the years that at least I've seen that whether it's, you know, education or tax policy or economic development policy, we seem to, you know, do all the benchmarking and put in place at the time what we think is the right policy. But then we switch just a few years later to something else, and it sets us back relative to the other states that we are constantly competing with. So, I mean, I think that, you know, what we've got to try to do is to, when we get, you know, locked in on good policy or something that we think is really going to give us an advantage, to stick with it long enough to actually see the results. You know, the more recent example I could give is kind of the changes we've had in our standards that we help to hold our kids accountable for with education. When we keep changing those standards, it seems like every year we change the testing methodology every year, and that just confuses everybody. So that's the one thing that I think has been probably the most challenging, at least for us to get through.
In the current role that you have, I know you've worked to develop some COVID-19 resources for the business community. What have your members been telling you? What are their concerns? What do you see as sort of the short-term horizon that the business community has to face going forward?
Well, the number one concern is safety for, you know, their employees, for their customers, for the public at large, and that's got to be the top priority. I think they're concerned for their businesses because of the impact that it has on the families that are part of those businesses. The economic stress that creates, the uncertainty that it creates. So I think that, you know, the thing that more than any thing that's going to be meaningful right now is to have some certainty about that we are going to get through this, that there is a time schedule, that if we continue to make the progress that we've been making from a public health standpoint, when you can expect to see certain things happen in terms of reopening the economy, and also then what's going to be evaluated to determine if we have to pull back at some point. I think the governor's beginning to do that right now, which I think is very, very important. And I think the more we can do it, it's going to give everybody that much more comfort.
Specifically with this COVID-19, once it passes, have you thought much about how you envision, I guess, workplaces changing or our work lives changing? I know you think a lot about sort of the future and trends.
Yeah, I think, John, that we're not going to go back to the way we were before. And I think there's a couple of areas that I think that we need to look at, and I think the state should look at from a policy standpoint. So one, I think that you're going to see supply chains change. I think that there's going to be more of an awareness that we can't have them as far-flung as we have, especially for critical supplies and materials. And so I think there's an opportunity there for Michigan to try to, you know, grab some of that business that relates to our core industries. I don't think we're going to go back to learning and working the way we were in the past. I mean, you know, before we jumped on this podcast, we talked about how efficient it's been to use video conferencing and working from home. And I think that, you know, the days when everybody has to show up at the office and everybody's got to be in huge face-to-face meetings, I think there's going to still be that, but I don't think there's going to be as much of it, perhaps, as we've had in the past. And I think the same thing for schooling. I think that you're going to see, you know, distance learning come more into play. And I was talking to some folks about this earlier in the week. Some school districts in Michigan actually have put that in place years ago, and they've been very easily able to transition to what we're going through right now to keep their kids on track. The districts that haven't done that are the ones that are experiencing the problems. So I think, you know, using distance, the technology to enable learning and work to occur in a 24/7 cycle, I think is going to also be a big change that's happened from all this.
I was speaking earlier today with an official from one of the large internet providers, and how much of an emphasis do you think the business leaders are going to start putting on making sure that our infrastructure supports the kind of changes you were just talking about, for example, in the form of better internet, broadband?
Yeah. Well, I think that right now, I mean, you have to wonder, you know, we've been stressing the importance of fixing the roads, but, you know, given what we've just gone through, it wouldn't be a bad idea to say, well, you know, if we're going to bond some money, maybe we'd use the bond, at least it doesn't cost as much either. We put that into making sure we get last mile broadband service in some of our underserved areas, or we, you know, take some of the federal money that we're going to get and see if we can use it to beef up some of the development of curriculum, a distance learning curriculum to help our teachers, or, you know, laptops for our kids. So, yeah, I absolutely think that there's a fundamental change here. That it was occurring anyhow, but this is going to just accelerate it that much more.
If I recall right, when you were recruited by John Engler to come to Michigan, right, where did you come from originally?
Some would say outer space or something. I worked in Delaware. I was the chief of staff to the governor of Delaware immediately before I came to Michigan. Although I was born and raised in Philadelphia, I went to school at University of Delaware and at UNC Chapel Hill. So Delaware was my last spot. And actually, my wife and I were wanting to move out to the West Coast because we love outdoors, love nature. And I met John Engler at a new governor's conference, and he said, well, you ever thought about coming to Michigan? And the answer was no, we hadn't, but he convinced us to come out. And, you know, we always loved the state because we visited vacation. We've been up north and all. And once we got to meet John and the rest of the people that were in the state government, we just said, hey, you know, this just feels right. It feels really comfortable. And it was the best move we ever made.
So I take it your post-retirement plans, you're not going to be leaving the state, or are you?
We are, because, you know, we lived in Ann Arbor for the last 20 years or so, and we love it there. We really do. But, you know, we both said, you know, first of all, Sharon's, my wife's mom has got some health issues, and she, of course, lives in North Carolina, which is where Sharon and I met. And we said, you know, we love living in Ann Arbor, but it's not, you know, we love Michigan, but it's not our college. We love college towns. And we said, well, you know, maybe we could move somewhere warmer. And we said, well, why don't we move back to our college town, Chapel Hill? And so that's what we've decided to do. We're going to move to Chapel Hill. We've already got a condo there, and that'll be our home.
Okay. Well, good for you. And we wish you the best. And we've enjoyed covering you at MERS. And look forward to, I guess, staying in touch and keep us all up to date via social media on what you're up to.
We will, John. And again, thank you for all you're doing and the work that MERS does to keep us all informed in this time when news is more important than ever.
All right.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Ken Sikkema and Bob Emerson for taking time with us. Also, Doug Rothwell for talking with us. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
Happy trails to you.